Good morning, and welcome to the live Book Business and Publishing Executive webinar, How Publishers Are Forging a Path to Digital Profitability, sponsored by Synveo Publisher Services. I'm Dennis Wilson, Editor-in-Chief of Book Business and Publishing Executive and host of today's event. Today's webinar will be in a roundtable format featuring our three guest speakers, and we will explore how publishers are forging a path to profitability, employing different strategies for making digital products profitable. Before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions at the end of the hour, but you can send them at any time. Please turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so you can utilize all of the widgets at the bottom of this console. Your console is interactive. Click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn how you can customize your experience today. I'm thrilled to have here today with me three executives who have spent their careers working in the publishing industry. Jim McQueen is Director of Digital Media at Synveo Publisher Services. Jim works with all of Synveo customers to expand their reach and provide digital solutions for content owners to improve their mobile services and ultimately increase revenues. Stephanie Garrett, Program Manager at Sage Publications, oversees the development of Sage Video product line. Her determination to create exceptional products and tools specifically for a complex academic library market led her to Sage in 2014, where she focuses on developing a suite of streaming video products forthcoming to the market in the first half of 2015. She's dedicated to developing web strategies that maximize user engagement and return on investment. Mitch Ruda is president of Farm Journal eMedia, the online division of Farm Journal Media, a position he has held since June of 2010. He began his career as an editor and got started in digital media at the dawn of the internet age. From 2000 to 2006, Ruda served as president of Hanley Wood eMedia, growing that business from $500,000 to more than $20 million. In just over 4 years running the digital media group at Farm Journal, Ruda has more than tripled the group's business in that time. To start things off, I was hoping that each of you, Jim, Mitch, and Stephanie, could tell us a little more about your background, your company, and specifically how you're working with digital products. Jim, would you mind kicking things off?
Sure. Yeah, my name is Jim McQueen. Welcome, everybody. Basically, what we've been doing is, you know, helping our clients and all the different verticals that we have within the Synveo organization and provided them tools that they're looking for to either publish online, to build online, to XML, all the way through do they want apps or they want HTML5. So what we do is provide a lot of different platforms for them to be able to come into and be able to go into the mobile, go into HTML5, the different things that they're looking to do. And we run three different levels of platforms that allows the customers to start sometimes in a smaller, at a starter level, and then they grow into what they want to do next as they build their audience. I've been working with ability of transforming documents into this for many years, and we basically, you know, are constantly evolving the technology as it evolves with our clients.
Great. Stephanie, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, yeah. So I'm Steph Garrett. Thank you for having me today. And as Dennis noted, I'm currently serving as the program manager of video here at Sage Publications. I'm based in the Washington, D.C. office. So Sage was founded in 1965 by Sarah Miller McCoon with her husband, George, which is where the name comes from, the first two letters of their name, S-A-G-E, for Sage. And I believe in next year we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of Sage's inception. So Sarah was in her early 20s when she created Sage, and she did so with a driven passion for education and research and how they can create a better society when put together. Sarah remains majority owner of the company, and Sage is, upon her death, is actually going to turn into a charitable trust, which guarantees our independence and focus in the future. So it's a pretty rare thing to be at Sage because it's a publishing company. For our size, we remain independent and will in the future. Today at Sage, we actually publish over 750 journals, including those of over 300 learned societies, over 800 new books per year, a growing range of library products, including archives, data, case studies, reports, conferences, highlights, and video. And we have a publishing office in Los Angeles, London, Washington, D.C., New Delhi, Boston, Singapore, and a growing range of sales offices around the world. And I'm actually currently with my position, my role at Sage sits in the online products team where we're focusing on delivering world-class products and commercially successful products, specifically to the academic library market and research institutions. And we're really in the online products team, customer and focused and community focused. And we have a number of product managers and analysts focusing on the delivery and the organization of current and future offerings to the academic library market. So
great,
in my current,
oh, sorry, go ahead.
I just want to note that while right now I'm responsible for driving the strategy and approach for forthcoming video suite. My role prior to that was a career at Alexander Street Press and a short stint at the American Physiological Society where I was focused on redesigning and creating new products and features. So I've served in a myriad of roles, licensing editor, production manager, and project software manager. And I've only ever been digital first. So my background is not necessarily surrounding the transformation or the transition. Well, I'm focusing first on digital.
Great. Glad to have you aboard. And Mitch, would you mind telling us a little bit about your work with Farm Journal eMedia?
Oh, sure. Sorry, I was on mute for a second there. So my name is Mitch Ruda, and I run the digital side of Farm Journal. Farm Journal is the largest independent media company serving America's farmers, B2B platform, and we are a fully multimedia operation. We're about a quarter print. That's with five titles. Farm Journal is the flagship and is a 137-year-old publication. But about a quarter of our business is in broadcast. We produce four TV shows, one a daily morning TV show syndicated on hundreds of stations nationwide, a weekly broadcast called the U.S. Farm Report that's syndicated on, I think, 500 stations nationwide. We produce radio. We have two daily radio shows, so that's about a quarter of our business. About a quarter of our business is the digital side, which I run. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a second. And then the other quarter is events. We produce about 80 events. We have some paid content streams, and we have a database business, particularly around the demographics of farmers. We keep a database of all 2 million farmers in America and know who they are and what they do. The digital side of our business revolves around a portal called AgWeb. It is by far the largest online destination for the agricultural community. We serve about 500 or 600,000 unique visitors a month. They produce about 5 million page views on the website. We have a large email footprint, so with 20 different email newsletters, many daily across a 300,000 person list. And we have a very large mobile footprint. As you might imagine, farmers are mobile and not really desk-oriented. We always thought of farmers as laggards in the road to Internet adoption, but they are leaders in the road to smartphone adoption. 40% of our use on AgWeb comes from mobile devices. In addition, we have what I call 4.5 apps, four that are real apps that you can get in the iOS or Android stores, and another app-like entity that is really an HTML5 product that is not available in the stores because it does not meet Apple's standards. I could tell you more about that. What it basically is a review of other apps, and Apple does not permit review sites of apps.
Right.
We also have one other product of note in digital, which is a subscription service of SMS and MMS messaging. And so we have 80,000 farmers that receive between 1 and 9 text messages on their phone from us a day. Typically, these are about market prices. Farmers care about the price of commodities in the Chicago Board of Trade pits. And we shoot out prices as they change, and we shoot out news alerts that may influence those prices. Just say two other quick things. One is I mentioned that Farm Journal is 137 years old. It is a private independent company, so we get to do what we like. We follow a tradition of service journalism that was started by our founder, and I think it's the heart of our franchise. People, after John Deere, the Farm Journal is the next most known brand in agriculture. Well, and then I guess I was going to make one other personal point, because I'm not a digital native. I'm old enough to have met my wife cutting up galleys. I used to be an editor in the days of galley type, and my wife was a killer art director who on deadline could rewrite paragraphs from type in the garbage can. But, all right, go ahead.
Thanks, Mitch. Well, I'm glad to have such a diverse group of experts here, and I think that plays well to our audience. I know that we have people from a lot of different segments in the industry. I'm going to pull up our next slide that's about how users are engaging on different platforms. And given the fragmentation of the platforms that users are accessing publisher content, I think it's important to understand that the audiences interact and engage with content differently throughout the day. And I was wondering, Jim, if you could tell us a little about what this entailed and how it applies to publishers these days.
Yeah, this was talk about this response engagement that we're looking at here. And this basically shows when somebody's interacting with their mobile devices and when they're showing, you know, the tablet, when they're looking and reading and different things. It's really a great numbers to look at. You don't really sit there and think about when somebody's doing things and, you know, when they're at home at night and timing during the day. It also represents a lot of what we do in tracking. One of the things that we are able to do, because we work with so many different customers, we have over 9 verticals in our system today, and we're able to track all 9 verticals for our customers and able to see what's going on in the mobile world. So besides the, you know, when people are using the tablets, when are they reading the newspaper, or they're touching their magazines and different things, which it shows you in that responsive. The other part of it is some of the numbers would surprise you, and we run products that are, you know, tablet, mobile phones, and desktop, so they're HTML5, and they're able to get their product no matter what type of device they're on. It's all electronic. And right now, 84% are still using the desktop version, because most people are at work when they're accessing a lot of their stuff. And so it's interesting to see that. And, you know, tablets and mobile are about split 50-50. So about 16%, 8% is on tablet, and 8% is on mobile phones. So what we've seen in the last couple of years, the phones have really grown. And what I'm looking at for data, just so you understand, it's 458,000 views, visitors to the site, 7 million page views. So it's a really great cross-section to understand what's going on in the mobile world and what you're doing. And so between the responsiveness of looking when they're using devices and understanding how all the different verticals come together, it's a very interesting proposition, and you got to hit the, you know, all the different platforms. The other thing, too, about it is it's still the main platform of the mobile and the phones and the tablet is still iOS at 80%. So out of 7 million page views, 80%, not of the mobile, which was a total of, sorry, got that number backwards. The total visits was 56,000. 80% of that 56,000 comes out of 71. So 80% of the 71
was iOS devices, which is another interesting thing. We're seeing the other devices grow, but iOS, you're only talking about three devices. With everybody else, you're talking about 943 devices. So out of the devices that our customers are using, there was 943 were Android and Amazon devices, and the rest of the three were Apple iOS, but iOS still has 80% of all the web response. So that's interesting in the mobile world.
Right.
That's just some data to talk about what's happening and what we provide back to our clients so they can understand where they're going to move things to, what their next proposal, do they want to stay in a world that can go to every device, or are they looking to move into more app-driven pieces? And we give them that opportunity to see what's going on.
Right. I'm wondering, Mitch and Stephanie, if you could tell me a little bit about how your, you know, what observations you've seen with Farm Journal and Sage in terms of how your audience is engaging throughout the day or and on different devices. Mitch, I know you said that that your mobile is very large and growing.
Yeah, so, I mean, we started to see the movement of our audience to mobile about 2 years ago, and, you know, first we noticed it was 10%, then 15%, then 20%. In the last few months, it's been running about 40%. That's about 30% on phone and 10% on tablet. We have a very seasonal and temporal use of our online products. Seasonally, obviously, farmers work very hard in the spring and the fall, and in the often 20 hours a day in the fields. And so our use goes way down on desktop at that time. In the summer and winter is when they do a lot of their planning and researching, and so our use goes way up. But in the spring and fall, we see particular leaps in our mobile use. People also tend to use our sites in the morning, in the noon, in and evening. As I mentioned to the guys here as we were preparing for the call, AgWeb, our core portal, is in the process of being rebuilt, and you will see a brand new AgWeb, I think, next week. So we are right at, in the QC, the final QC stages of a brand new website. The website you see today is about 4 years old. The new website was we rebuilt our back-end platform primarily to make the site more responsive and help our mobile users who right now get an inferior experience. But as we were doing research for that project, we spent a lot of time on individual interviews with dozens of farmers. We would call them in one by one with a facilitator and a, you know, a closed-circuit camera and ask them about their media use and use habits. And they told us something that really has driven our thinking a lot, that in print they are very much willing to put themselves in the hands of the editor and to devote uninterrupted time to reading a print product that they liked from cover to cover. And so they would spend a half hour, an hour in the evening with their favorite magazine when it arrived, and they were willing subjects in the editor's hands. But online they come as men with missions, and they tend to come in, come out with a question and want an answer. They like AgWeb because we have lots of answers. But we, like many publishers, often want to drive more page views, more engagement, and we often think about how do we get more page views per visit session, how do we sell other pages that we have on the website. And one of the things we learned from them is that we would have an easier time selling more frequent visits than lengthier visits. And this all circles back to your question about time of day. So we know that news happens as the day goes by, and being very clear about we have new news in the morning and new news in the middle of the day and new news in the evening creates more engagement.
I see. And Stephanie, you have a very different audience, obviously, but what are you seeing in terms of usage and anything you're doing to kind of respond to that?
Yeah, so I think that there is the same thing with periodicity as well. So we have low spikes in the afternoon and lower usage in the morning generally, but the spikes are generally later in the early evening. But that's less interesting than looking over the trend over time, which I think generally is the case with metrics, and looking at the different times of day or the tablets being used. So right now, the way that it looks is that our goal for the market and communities is to sell to institutions around the world. So we generally see some traffic and a good amount of traffic all day throughout every day because we're selling products in almost every country and at least every territory, North America, Asia Pacific, Australia, and South America, and Europe. So where I do observe trends is seasonally. So in, as Mitch noted, so in the summer we actually see significant drops, and we do quite a bit of our updates and enhancements and changes to content and digital products in the summer because there's just not that many courses in session because we're in the academic library market selling to faculty and students. So they're just generally not using the product. And even if we see a huge spike on one day, it's usually an anomaly whereby there might have been one summer class that had a huge, was an online class that got a ton of usage for and engagement through the product there. And then in September and October, we see a huge uptick in our usage, and it's on multiple channels, especially come October and November, where students are getting quite comfortable with the products and the content and the resources available to them for their education and learning at an institution. We see huge upticks there where it's on tablet and quite a bit of mobile usage at that point. Early days, you see a lot more in September and late August. The only usually the web desktop devices. And then again, and first week in December, from what we can tell and what our market research has historically said, and this is for basically every company I've ever worked at, is that students basically start to freak out a little bit about midterms and the spike in, or the usage on the products and the resources. Had a huge spike right before the winter holiday. So the trend of seasonality, especially in North America academic calendar year, is generally the driving periodicity of high and low engagement with our online products and content.
I see. Interesting. We're just going to pull up the next slide, which is related to what we were talking about with the evolution to mobile. Obviously, we're seeing that growth across the board, not just with publishers. But, Jim, could you walk us through this slide a little bit and some of the metrics pertaining to the growth of mobile?
Well, when you look at the slide and the slide previous, what you're seeing is, you know, more and more people are using their mobile products. The phones are of course, growing at leaps and bounds. And so what's happening is you're looking at the amount of content people are consuming, so everything is moving more towards the mobile, more mobile being used. But the interesting thing is what's happening is, you know, PC shipments are down. So you're seeing a decline constantly in actual desktops and laptops. You're actually seeing a reduction of all the units over year, each year, and you're looking at the growth of mobile going up. And we're looking at mobile changing constantly, too, because we started out with a phone that fit in our hand, then we went to a tablet. And now we're going to a phone bigger than our hand, and the tablet's getting a little bit, so the phone becoming more like a tablet. So depending on your customer base and what they're trying to accomplish and who they are, they're going to use the different devices in the mobile world to give them their content. So what you're finding is the mobile world that, you know, they're searching on their tablets, they're searching on their phone tablets. So it's all about being connected. And what's happening in the world is, you know, we're constantly tagging each other, we're constantly talking, we're text messaging. The growth of the communication process and the need to have information right away. As Mitch said, you know, farmers are sitting there running through their fields, they're inside there on their tractors, and they're on their phone looking at the current sales rates. You know, what's the wheat selling for? What's this going for? So they're connected while they're working. And that's what you're seeing with everybody. So the evolution of mobile is just going to continue. It's going to grow more and more as we look at the products that are out there today, too, because, once again, the tablets are starting to break apart. They're getting bigger, and the phones are getting bigger. So the world of interactivity is what's growing and helping us in our mobile platforms.
Well, let me skip then to the next slide, which asks, is digital a threat or an opportunity? It's not meant just to be a bait question. Digital and mobile specifically has presented a lot of challenges for publishers. When it comes to apps, some people are concerned about content getting locked in and hurting discoverability. Content is being pushed out to so many platforms, there's an expectation from the users that, you know, content is ubiquitous and often free. So we can unpack this question one by one, or does anybody want to address at a high level whether digital is a threat and opportunity? And I'm guessing how you're turning it into an opportunity would be pertinent here.
So this is an interesting question, but I think it's kind of difficult to answer it without asking another question, because I think the most important thing here for every department, organization, person kind of needing to answer this question, understand it, is what is your intent? So in some cases, it may be an app that can enhance your content in a way that the web cannot translate to. Another case might be a focus on driving people together and creating community around their own content for sharing. That's easy. That's easier through an app than, say, a web-based. And in many cases, the idea is to reach as many users as possible with the content that you're already publishing and creating, which means you need to have recognizable and, in my opinion, intuitive experiences on content or tablets or phones or web. But in order to know whether it's a threat or an opportunity for yourself, I feel pretty strongly that you have to first answer that question of what your intent is and the who you want the content to reach and in what time frame, and really what you expect and what you want people to use your content and how you want them to use it. Specifically for my role now, when I look at the device percentages and their increases month over month, which at Sage right now we're running at about anywhere between 12 and 35% given a product on our total usage being on a device given a month. And that growth is anywhere between 2 and 5% month over month. So we actually know that it's growing exponentially within and across our market and its device users. And we have so much original and rigorously editorially curated content that it's really important for us to look at getting the content there through an amazing and intuitive mobile and tablet experience, or for video and all the other content types that we have. In the case of video, we need to consider a number of operating systems and browsers. So formatting the optimal discoverability on the web, making sure that your XML is wrapped in such a way that it can handle and deal with that on devices and operating systems. But also for us, we have library discovery systems that are, whether you're an app in the App Store, which brings its own set of consequences, which I think Mitch said he would speak to, we have library customers that have systems that we need to actually have major intentions about how we push the content to them, how it's formatted, because they've kind of set a standard that we need to adhere to, which is something that everyone should understand about their market, about whether there's a standard that we're already needing to work up to or that we've already met and needing to surpass in the future.
Great, thanks. Mitch, I'll give you an opportunity to answer that, but I'm going to skip to the next slide and first just cover this. This is a result of a survey that Syndeo Publisher Services launched. The survey called Making Digital Pay captures responses on a number of critical questions around monetizing digital products. And you can see here that it's 50-50 of those surveyed whether they offer an app. And Mitch, I know that you have quite a few apps. You told us a little bit about that. But could you tell us a little bit the thinking behind launching a couple of the apps? What service were you trying to provide for your audience, and how did you know it was going to be engaging and also create sponsorship opportunities for Farm Journal?
All right, so I want to just go up 70,000 feet for a second before I get into the apps.
Sure.
On mobile in general, and your question about opportunity or threat or whatever, Stephanie was talking about what do we want them to do, and I am very much focused on what do they want to do. and it's pretty clear they want to get our content on phones. And they and our, in that case, meant farmers and our farming content, but I think it's pretty clear that over the next 10 years, our computing experience will go into our hand. And maybe, you know, it's already largely in our hand, and I think it's pretty inevitable that a small-sized tablet is going to be about as much as we work with most of the time on everything. So that is, to me, just a given that we have to respond to. It does change our pages quite a lot as we try to deal with smaller size screens. I think among the – we are not a paid service. We are – almost everything that we do is free. Not everything, but almost everything that we do is free to qualified subscribers. On the Internet, it's open access, although we know that our use is something like 92% among professionals in agriculture. On the apps, I guess one more thought about apps. So we have customers accessing our content on phones. Only a small percentage of those are accessing our content using apps. The larger percentage are accessing our web content using mobile browsers. And right now that experience is okay on a tablet. It's not okay on a phone. As I told you, next week you'll see a brand new AgWeb that I believe will have a much superior experience on a phone. The apps, in my mind, serve a slightly different purpose, and our own use statistics will bear this out. So apps generally are appealing to your most loyal customers, and this is true of Target as it is of the Farm Journal or the New York Times. In Target's case, they do a lot of mobile advertising. They do it across lots of platforms, not their own, but they also have a Target app, and they know that their 5% most loyal customers are the only people that will ever use that app. And so if they want to reach the other 95%, they're not on app. The app is not on their minds. But that 5% is a key core group, just similar to your social media streams where your Facebook fans represent a core and loyal group. So in our case, we see 10x the usage on our phones accessing AgWeb. 90% of them are going through the mobile browser, and 10% are using our apps. But interestingly, the 10% that are using our apps create as many page views as the 90% that are using our mobile browser. So they are about 10x more engaged. They're one-tenth of the audience, 10x more engaged. And so you have to use both. Now, our apps, we have three news apps that are basically, one is called AgWeb. You'll find it in the store under AgWeb. The other two that are news apps are in the beef and dairy categories. But they present a streamlined, abbreviated version of our content where you can only get not all the articles that we write, not all the, but a news stream, a weather stream, a markets table stream, a little bit of audio and video. And so it is a, we call it a reader. It's like a quick take, but it's the kind of thing that, that as I told you, people often will look at 30 page views in a day. So we also have another app that you'll find called Cash Grain Bids. It'll be an example of a very quick, cool tool. It does one very specific thing, finds you current prices from local grain elevators. I won't get you lost in farming, but something somebody cares about. And it does that with a sponsor. Now, on the money side, a page view is a page view, and we monetize page views with advertising and marketing devices of all types, from native advertising to broad-range multimedia sponsorships. So mostly we care about getting more engagement. But sometimes, like that Cash Grain Bids tool set app, that just has a single sponsor. So we brought it to market. We knew what it was going to cost us to create it. We marked it up and put one sponsor across it, and everybody's happy.
I see. Well, I've moved to the next slide because that's basically what we're talking about here, what monetization methods are publishers using to generate revenue from digital products, speaking more broadly than just apps. Stephanie, I understand that you've only recently got into focusing on the development and release of apps, but can you share some experience of some other digital offerings that you've had quite a bit of success with?
Sorry, I was on mute again. I think that as far as other digital offerings that we've kind of been or have been very successful with, I think there's a lot. So there are many sites, there are responsive designs, and there are quite a few of just product offerings and features that have been developed and offered. So I guess if the question is what type of other things, I think one of the things we focus on in our market are subscription-based modules or content that we can provide, that those drive direct revenue. And those are, I guess, really good. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, can you describe what those modules are a little bit? What they serve?
So one of the major ones we do is we'll have a quite a large product, say an e-book collection that is available with hundreds of thousands of books, and it is the main idea of it when it first began was that it was an e-book platform that needed to be quite robust and having everything and everyone's needs. And one of the things that after creating such a platform, it created a different opportunity for us where people came back to us, our customers came back to us and said, you know, I'm quite interested in this ebook platform, but specifically, I'm only a business and management library, and the only way that my budget can really support buying such a robust platform is if you only create a module that focuses on business and management. And so with that module, instead of just slicing that content and delivering it to them, we would actually enhance it and add some metadata that was specific to business schools, whether it be general people or major concepts within business schools that are discussed, maybe adding a few case studies around a book content. We add modules that kind of increase the value and the usefulness depending on the discipline. And we're really focused on discipline-based offerings so that people within the social sciences and academic libraries cannot just have, if they want robust and they want lots of content, that's one offering. But there's a more specific offering and an opportunity, especially in our market, to focus only on getting sales and driving revenue and usage through focusing on what we can do to serve a discipline. And that would be one major offering we have. Another offering that's not necessarily revenue-driven, but actually usage-driven, and a really important one is we do provide apps for our journals, and we're rolling out with more and more apps over time. We have hundreds and nearly 1,000 journals that we offer through society publishers. And one of the things we're working through is we have what we call like mini sites, which are those are web-based and they're kind of smaller versions. And going to it on your phone or tablet, it's kind of like a mobile-first version of a device. And that really draws in quite a bit. But there's also another element here where sometimes the content is not about just delivering it quickly. There can be some enhancements through an app. So we would take maybe the top five subjects or the top five articles that were published within an app. And this is currently just an idea in the works right now, very early stages. But taking the top five articles from across journals or across disciplines and putting that together and offering that just to give people a flavor of what's happening. And it drives usage to the fuller piece of content. So we may only offer the abstracts within the app, but if you'd like to have the full article, that will drive you to the website or drive you to a sales rep who can help you with that.
Great. Thank you. I want to have Jim answer the below question, how do you measure success? So we actually had some questions come in from some of the audience talking about how things have changed, obviously, from traditional concepts of sales and units sold to how you track success. Jim, can you talk about the metrics that publishers, you're seeing them, what they're eyeing as benchmarks for success and what they should be, how they should be valuing users in their ecosystem?
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about one particular client, and because they actually use, they do catalogs in a newsletter, and they're global. And what they did is the catalog is a replica because it's a print product. Their newsletter was designed for tablets for easy reading, not have to zoom up, and it's in three languages. And they're being a global company. They're trying to, you know, they're doing English, French, and Spanish because that's where they're schools, they're basically international baccalaureate, and it's very interesting to see what's been going on in the last couple of years. But they had a catalog that they always printed late in the year, and what they found out by using the digital version, the catalog actually had more hits, more usage, more link-throughs during the summer period. So printing the catalog, they had to move the print of the catalog up into the springtime out of the fall time because really they saw a real low usage in fall and a high usage towards the end of the school year. So it made them really rethink their process and how to communicate to all the teachers out there for all the classes. The second part of that, so that's all about metrics and usage and, you know, the other one was the newsletter and, you know, trying to promote and doing it in three different languages. And what they ended up doing is getting a really global audience. And this past year, the newsletter produced 1 million page views, which is huge for the product it is. It's information, a lot of link-throughs. So when you sit there and think about what's going on with this particular client and what they're using their metrics for, they're looking at and testing different products on a consistent basis to see how it interacts. Also, because they are in the other countries, you'll find that the Android devices are larger use in there, so their phones are a larger use, so the product has to really fit their phone. But the interesting, just in the past month, out of 10,000 visitors, they actually printed 3,700 pages of the product. So they're actually still printing pieces of it. The other part of it is they had 4,000 click-throughs back into their website that takes them into the courseware and all the other things that they're looking for. So they're constantly tweaking their product, adding their product, and massaging it depending on the metrics. And they've been very happy because these products are actually driven by email. And these are high numbers for email product. And when you look at their viewing time, they're finding out that their clients are spending a minimal of 5 minutes on the mobile portions. So they're getting that attention span is usually about 5 minutes, which is pretty good. So when you look at the different ways of taking the metrics and expanding it out. And I'm talking about a product that's free, but it's providing 1 million page views, and it's providing over 100,000 click-throughs back into their website. If for people to go deeper, it shows that the real value of the product.
Thanks, Jim. That leads well into our next point, which will be marketing. But I do want to encourage folks, attendees, to ask questions. I popped up our each of our speakers there. You can feel free to ask directly specific questions or broadly to the group. But I do want to talk about touch on marketing quickly because it relates to what Jim was saying. And as everybody has described throughout, is engagement is important in driving adoption. So I wanted to ask Stephanie and Mitch, this is related to some audience questions that have come in. How are you driving engagement? What are you doing in marketing in terms of maybe it's email marketing, driving people from your print to your digital and vice versa? Mitch, do you want to maybe start with that?
Yeah, sure. Am I on the phone?
Yep, you're live.
Sorry, I was trying to get it off the speaker. We use all of our tools and toys to drive traffic, and including editorial. So, I mean, when we introduce new products, we'll typically write editorials about them or stories about them in our magazines, on TV. That just seems kind of normal. tell people about what we do. I'm not sure if there's more detail than that.
No, that helps. I did have a question come in that I think that is also relevant to your experience. When you mentioned the sponsorship of your apps, the question is, what kind of metrics are you focusing on when you communicate the offer to the advertiser? Is it sessions, session time, impressions? What kind of things are you?
Yeah, typically unique users and page views. And I mean, we keep track of a lot of metrics, and we've talked a little bit about how do you measure success, and obviously, you know, you can measure success on money, but you can also measure it on engagement, and we watch our engagement, our source of traffic, how often they're on the site, how much they use the site, length of time, where they go, all that stuff. But in pricing, I think it generally comes down to reach and frequency. And so that unique visitors is a measure of reach and page views is a measure of frequency. And those two together, we made a guess on that before we launched an app. And that's always a little bit tricky when you want to launch a new product and you want a sponsor to help you get there. And so you have to make a guess of what you think you can do and price it based on that. And generally, things online, they're very measurable. And so most of our campaigns are sold with guarantees of reach. If we didn't reach that, we would have to extend the campaign or refund money, but we, you know, blew by it, and then we're able to raise the price on the renewal.
Great. Thanks for answering that. I'm going to start getting to some of the audience Q&A because we have quite a few questions come in. And the first is, what is the strategy for breaking the vicious cycle? And this is the vicious cycle is we could increase sales revenue with more traffic that would result from more content, but we don't have the revenue to produce more content. It's the chicken and egg scenario. Over many years, both will rise naturally. How can we drive both higher today? And I'll open that up to the floor.
I mean, I'd love to take a crack at that.
Sure.
And I think that is the tough question. We have a situation in all media where how cheap can you produce how much content? And that is in large part a lot of our game. Before everybody hangs me, quality content totally matters. And so we think about our 5 or 7 million page views that we're driving on our platform. It comes in little chunks of stories that got 6,000 views, and how many stories can you – so if you have 100 stories that got 6,000 views, there are 600,000. And then we have data tables, and the data tables people like to look at. So incidentally, on our website, you'll find commodity prices streaming live from the Chicago Board of Trade. That is almost public information. But we've arranged it in a very good and convenient way. And so this is information you can get in lots of places. It is not proprietary. We pay a service to get that feed and get that feed processed for us in a graphically acceptable way. But it then generates page views while we sleep. Similarly, user-generated content is free. Curated content, you can get tools that curate content and let you build a page view out of fair use. So you troll the web, you find stories in your area, you abstract or grab the first 70 words, and then you lead off to the source site. That's, again, free content. Now, if we only did that, people wouldn't come to us. So they come to us because they know we do seminal investigative journalism as well. And I think we all have to balance free content, paid content, cheap content, contributed content. We all want more content, that's right, and we all have to fight price, that's right.
Right.
I think all of those comments are exactly right. I think the only thing I would add to that, and we have a lot of this similar, while it's very different markets and products, that was a very similar experience, is that there are ways to – The presentation and the context that you can give of any piece of content generally can drive the value of it and then lead to revenue and help. One of the things that I've noticed in our market in the last probably 2.5 to 3 years is And this kind of helps one of our goals of our marketing team here in our market research group is that a market awareness about us and about our offerings has been a huge driver. And a lot of the things that we're doing internally are actually not a huge cost up front. There's a time sink there, but and there's a time kind of contribution. So things like a blog series and white papers, or contributing to blogs or listservs, and not in a kind of advertising way, which is one way to do it, but that's more annoying. But actually being quite engaged in your community that you're seeking to publish with and publish to is a huge driver of awareness, and we've noticed remarkable upticks in usage and request and people wanting to actually contribute to and work to us because they've noticed that we have a presence within the community already and they are aware of us. And speaking to prospective customers about generally getting their feedback, not necessarily because we're wanting to sell to them, but we wanted to understand them more and we want them to make them aware of what we're doing constantly, whether they buy or access our content or not.
I see. I have another question here, and this may apply to both. I think, Stephanie, this might be up your alley. It's kind of a three-part question, but all related. How critical is it to have a chunking bundling strategy for delivering digital content? Is it cost-effective to give customers the ability to create their own bundles? Is there value in researching the audience and creating the bundles for them?
Wow. Yes, is the short answer. The longer answer to that is absolutely cost-effective in creating bundles. It's interesting because there are different types of discounts and kind of offerings that you can package things. There's early bird specials. The bundling discount is one that we in the academic publishing world use significantly. And there's interesting bundles and things you can find out about your customers through bundling. So bundling via discipline. Bundling versus the content type, if you have mixed media, images, audio, and text. There's bundling packages where it's based off of some type of region. So there could be regional content specific. I know there was a product that we once had that had it was focused around local history. And so being able to bundle and give price discounts for someone that didn't want the entire East Coast region but really actually only wanted local history about, say, South or Virginia and Georgia and Alabama specifically and getting bundles this way. So one of the things that gets quite difficult and messy is letting your customer choose a bundle because the science and the art of bundling, in my opinion, is really based off of the expense that it costs you to make your content. So if you have more expensive content and then you're getting even more expensive content or something that it takes a while to produce it, whether maybe it be the operational model, the difficulty of curation, to allow your customers to bundle and discount their content for expensive with expensive is sometimes not as cost effective. So really you kind of want to curate your bundles, if that is a fair way of putting it, and move forward with kind of testing those bundles and what works best and really working with their feedback as much as possible. Was there a third question in there that I didn't answer, Dennis?
No, I think you covered it. Did anybody else want to comment on that? Or I could ask a couple more questions. We got about 5-6 more minutes. Well, I will move along because we may not be able to do this question justice in only 5 minutes, but this question is, do you think the future of digital magazines is beyond the PDF flipbook? And I know that before our call that Mitch and I and I think Jim were talking about the future of the digital magazine. So what do you think? Is the future beyond the PDF flipbook, or does the digital magazine have a future itself?
With all the technology changes that have been going on, with the ability to actually incorporate InDesign into the digital workflows and what Adobe's been doing, and now with other vendors able to take that information directly in, one of the things that we're starting to see is we have a lot more clients that are very much interested in taking their print product and at the same time build a mobile product and have the ability to update across the board.
so that they can give a better experience. It's all about the experience. So once again, when we talk to clients, you know, a lot of them might start out at a flip book, but their goal is to move it into a more designed to fit so the customer is easy to read, easy for them to get information, easy for them to flow through. And I see that growing, but what's really growing with it, once again, but we're not just talking mobile, we're also talking on the desktop. So what they're trying to do is take their print and provide it across all platforms. So HTML5 plays a big role in that, so that they're still going to have print product and they'll have that ability to take that content and mobilize it also at the same time, also import it into their website. Being that we work with a lot of publishers in the STM market space, they have a ton of content and they're putting their content everywhere they can to allow the usage and the growth of that content. And so a lot of them are using all the different tools available to them today.
Great. Mitch, could you speak to that as well, what your thoughts are?
Yeah, and I think academic publishing is quite a bit different than B2B information delivery, but as I was telling you before, Dennis, I have not found digital magazines or flipbooks to generally meet our audience's needs. I mentioned to the group here today about the way our audience uses information online. It tends to be episodic and quick, and so they tend to not be – it's lean forward, not lean back. And so they tend to not want to engage in a magazine format. So we do have some of our magazines that have digital replicas available, but we don't pay much attention to them and don't believe it's generally used much by our audience. They prefer the very same content reformatted in web or mobile-friendly pages.
Great, thanks. Well, we have a couple more minutes, so I will go to one more question. I've been told, this is a question, I've been told not to have high expectations in terms of increasing our subscriber base by bundling print and digital edition and apps. Do you think that is true or for most consumer magazines? We could step outside of just consumer. This is a different kind of bundling. Jim, do you want to speak at all to that? The idea of bundling print, digital, and apps as opposed to selling them one-off?
It's, you know, what we find a lot of our clients actually will start in the app world and because I'm not in the consumer space, so in the other space with our STM market newsletters and stuff, we find a lot of our clients start out offering the digital version as just another way for them to get their content, receive it and look at it and present it, and they can read it. So they start out, a lot of them, with leaving it open for months at a time, and then they move it back into their subscription process. And they offer, you know, of course, everybody wants to offer a customer many different ways of going, but basically what we see also is a lot of customers in certain market spaces are just saying, here's a price. If you want print, it's actually higher. If you want digital, it's a little bit cheaper. And so that's what we see a lot happening. But we also see them all start out where the digital's free. And the goal there is to build up the audience and to build to see if it's working. And if it's not working, they're going to make a change of what their process is.
Mm-hmm. Mitch, are you seeing a synergy between your print and digital? We touched on this a little bit before, but do you bring people in?
Absolutely. I think the question was mostly talking about bundling subscriptions, mm-hmm. and because we are free in all our channels on TV, on radio, in print, and in digital, it's more a question of attracting the audience again and again and again. I mentioned there are 2 million farmers in America, but there are 500,000 that matter. And so we spend a lot of time trying to find the right 500,000 and have them visit us in all of our media sources. We do separately, we are ad-supported in general, and we separately price all of our media, but we often sell them in a packaged bundle. And we think, in fact, that that's part of our success because we were able to create a multi-touch point marketing tool set.
Great. Unfortunately, we'll have to wrap things up here. It looks like we're just about out of time for today. I want to, on behalf of Book Business Publishing Executive and Symbeo Publisher Services, I want to first thank our speakers, Jim, Stephanie, and Mitch, for participating today. It was great to have a roundtable discussion to keep things lively. And I want to thank everyone for attending today's webinar. Be sure to check out our webinar page to get information on all of our archives and upcoming webinars. You can listen to this one. If you would like to take a minute to fill out the brief feedback survey that will appear on your next screen, we would be grateful. Your feedback will influence the webinars we bring to you in the future. I hope to see you at the next Publishing Executive and Book Business webinar. Thank you, everyone.